country he loved, and the role was full of contradictions that even years later he seemed to struggle with. I was working as a reverse advocate, but I was paid by a mining company. I was paid by an investment bank, he said. I'm not so naive as to think that my role wasn't guided by meeting their needs and their interests to a significant degree. Of course it was. It was not yet known, to him or anyone, whether foreign business interests would help the country in the ways they promised, or whether, as had so often been the case in the history of resource extraction, take what they could and run. He was paid to believe, and convince others, that what these companies wanted was the same as what Mongolia needed. A win-win. He had been hired to reconcile what was perhaps irreconcilable. Perhaps he realized that, for at one point some years ago, Hinton reached out to an iconic bearer of the protocols, who was having his own doubts. Michael Porter, a Harvard Business School professor who is considered the founder of modern corporate strategy, had seized Hinton's attention with a 2011 essay whose rather modest critique of the prevailing approach to business created a stir in a world not used to such friendly fire. Porter was among the most cited authors on business, and a godfather of theories about how business competition works and what makes societies competitive for business, which is to say, attractive to it. In addition to his teaching and writing, he had gotten into the protocol-spreading business himself, starting a consulting firm called the Monitor Group, and lending his advice to many healthcare reform efforts. He has influenced more executives and more nations than any other business professor on earth, Fortune magazine once proclaimed. And so in 2011, when Porter and a co-author named Mark Kramer published the essay Creating Shared Value in Harvard Business Review, it got the business world's attention. The capitalist system is under siege, Porter and Kramer wrote, in a fair impression of a 19th-century manifesto. Business was being criticized as a major cause of social, environmental, and economic problems. Companies were widely thought to be prospering at the expense of their communities. And who was to blame? A big part of the problem lies with companies themselves, they wrote. And what they blamed in the companies was an outdated, narrow approach to value creation. Companies had become too focused on optimizing short-term financial performance. They had acquired a dangerous tendency to overlook the greatest unmet needs in the market, as well as broader influences on their long-term success. Again and again, companies that employed droves of brilliant people and had high-priced outside advisors were making decisions that ignored the well-being of their customers, the depletion of natural resources vital to their businesses, the viability of suppliers, and the economic distress of the communities in which they produce and sell. Porter and Kramer were critiquing a culture that had overtaken the business world, the culture wrought by the atomizing protocols that obscured context. Hinton eventually met with Porter to seek his advice on how to structure his company's deals in Mongolia to be less protocol and more human. Now, several years later, Porter was sitting in a booth at Peacock Alley, in the refined but frenetic lobby of the Waldorf Astoria in New York, explaining how he had come around to questioning the work of the protocols. He had become interested in inequality after the Great Recession, especially after seeing some data on how well many American businesses and individuals had survived it and how badly the average citizen and worker had done by comparison. He said, "We started really thinking hard about what are we doing at Harvard Business School? What are we teaching here? Somehow we've missed a big piece of the equation." Those questions led him to his idea of shared value, that there were new ways of thinking about business goals and practices that would improve big companies' relationship with their communities. Porter showed up at the Waldorf that day with an agenda of hopefulness. He didn't want to talk about what people were doing wrong. "My view is that there are now very strong forces which can be tapped into," he said. "People knew the old ways of doing business weren't working. People wanted new ways. So it's a question of articulating what's the should rather than what's the not," he said. This reluctance toward the not was understandable for a man still very much of market world. But Porter's ideas on the not seemed of greater import, because if it was obvious to millions outside market world that the business protocols of the last generation had caused so many of the problems the world now confronted, It was, willfully, one suspects, not yet obvious to many within it. Perhaps hearing it from Michael Porter would undercut the plausibility of their denial. In Porter's careful, methodical way, he began to lay out how the business approach to life had, over a generation, contributed to some of the very societal ailments for which it now offered itself as a cure. At the heart of his account was a critique of the protocols, and how their piecemeal approach to reality, their rejection of the whole, had harmed people. Porter spoke of how companies over the last generation had pursued a vision of globalization in which they owed nothing to any community. This was simply because those taught by professors like him at places like Harvard Business School, groomed by consulting and Wall Street and other training grounds, tended to be agnostic about place. You analyzed the data, and then you went where the opportunity was. It didn't matter if that chase severed you from your own community and your obligations to it. There were many things that business traditionally did to support the community, from training people to whole sets of other activities that they sort of took responsibility for, which we call investing in the commons, Porter said. By commons, he meant the shared assets of a place, things such as public schools that both industry and average people benefit from. As people got disconnected from locations, business stopped really reinvesting in that. They thought their job was globalizing. This disconnection of which Porter spoke was abetted by the decontextualizing, disaggregating, ocean-boiling, avoiding approach of the protocols, by their tendency to atomize. Before the protocols had come to dominate the world of business, a company might have raised its money from not far away, sourced its inputs from not far away, sold to customers not far away, paid taxes to authorities not far away, and when growth came, parked the profit in a bank not far away, or reinvested it in a new venture with a plant not far away. But in recent decades, that began to change, as technology made it easier to do business with faraway entities, as new markets opened, and, importantly, as the financial wizards and management consultants increased their influence over boardrooms. These protocol-equipped figures pressed companies to embrace a new philosophy. Do each of your activities where it can be best done, wherever that might be. You raised money from Korean investors, sourced from Mexico, sold in France, paid taxes in the Caribbean, and, when growth hit, chose a Swiss bank or ethereal bitcoins to store the proceeds, or reinvested them in whatever venture on earth promised you the most attractive returns. It was an expansion of commercial freedom. Porter suggested, however, that it had disrupted an older pattern of companies behaving with a sense of citizenship. There is somehow a detachment because of this notion of globalization, that we're no longer an American company, he said. And the odds are that if you're operating all around the world, then you don't have any special requirement to worry about Milwaukee. Somewhere on the road to globalization, Porter said, the self-image of business as a pillar of community had yielded to a self-image of, we're global now and that's no longer our problem, he added. They started not accepting any responsibility for that community because they didn't think it was their job and they could always move somewhere else if that community didn't want to do its thing. This was a win-lose. The companies had flourished because of their freedom to escape and the community's lack of leverage. Porter's second area of criticism regarded optimization. Thanks in part to the emergent protocols, a new culture of business had developed in which each microscopic element of a company's activities had to be perfectly optimized. And this, Porter said, had made it easier to mistreat workers and ignore questions about one's effects on the larger system. These new protocols had succeeded because the business world they began to conquer in the latter half of the 20th century was often clubby, provincial, and very unoptimized. Many businesses, even big ones, operated like families, which many were still run by. You didn't sell everywhere you could sell, and at the exact best market price in each place. You sold where you knew someone who knew someone, and charged whatever your best guess was. You didn't pay workers more when demand spiked and less when it sank. You paid them an even salary. The management consulting firms, leveraged buyout companies, investment banks, and other bearers of the protocols, swept into this rather quainter business world over the last few decades and pressed for each of these pieces to be optimized. They did this through some combination of advisory projects the companies paid for, hostile takeovers after which they forced their new wards to straighten up, and shareholder pressure to lift the stock price. A new ethic of optimization spread across the business world, and at first, to Porter at least, it seemed entirely positive. He said, "We have learned a lot about how to run businesses more productively, and how to operate supply chains, and how to better deploy technology, and how to be smarter about procurement and purchasing." Over a generation, these efforts, many of which were incubated at Harvard Business School, made the economy as a whole more productive and competitive. Yet it was not a coincidence, Porter said, that as this slack got run out, as he put it, over the same period, life grew harder for many workers. "We ended up making business more productive, which allowed wage increases for many, many years, and good things. But we also, without even kind of realizing it, started building a disconnect between the business and their average employees." He brought up Starbucks. It had, like so many companies, begun to schedule workers using newfangled dynamic scheduling tools, which allowed employers to change schedules more often, so as to constantly optimize. It helped a company pay the smallest wage bill it could to service a given amount of demand. This kind of thing made a company more profitable, but it could bring chaos into workers' lives. They no longer knew how many hours they would get in a given period of time, which complicated paying bills and making purchases. They had to arrange childcare on the fly, Porter said. Somehow, in being efficient and being clever and being productive, people thought they had the license to just stop thinking about the human beings and the well-being of everybody else in the system. The same short-sightedness, Porter said, could be seen in highly profitable companies' insistence on low wages. "We turn many of these people into commodities, and we just kind of optimize it on us rather than optimize it in any way on them. So a lot of the labor practices, a lot of this idea that you should have contract workers and not have to pay benefits, all this stuff was just too clever, and everybody sort of justified it in terms of, oh, we're being productive and we're kind of maximizing our returns and that's somehow our job." Porter was making clear that business is not a fixed quantity. It can be done in different ways, following different approaches. It happened in recent decades to have been taken over by protocols that, in the name of making everything optimal, granted a license to neglect and even hurt others. "We sort of created a cartoon," Porter said, "which is this view of if you can force your employee to work overtime without paying them, then you should do it. That's free markets, and that's profit maximization." Finally, Porter spoke of how the spread of the financial vernacular of the protocols had caused companies to be run more and more for the sake of shareholders rather than for workers or customers or anybody else. "When I was first teaching," he said, "we didn't talk about shareholder value. What lodestars guided business back then? I think it was the business has to earn a good, sustained return, and we're in it for the long run, and we're building a great company," he said. "Rather than this notion that it's the stock market vote every day that determines whether you're succeeding or not." Back when businesses were run in a more localized and less scientific manner, they were also run for a variety of people. Shareholders were part of the mix, but the micro-movements of the share price were not the be-all, end-all indicator of a company's success, nor the guide to how it should be run. Of course, there was waste involved. A lot of capital was not put to the most efficient use. And then, in the 1970s and 80s, as ascendant neoliberalism spawned changes in law and culture, it came to be viewed as the first duty of a business to maximize value for shareholders. "The social responsibility of business is to increase its profits," the Chicago School economist Milton Friedman declared in the New York Times Magazine in the fall of 1970. Wall Streeters trained in the protocols saw their influence rise as their way of evaluating a company and their degree of say in how it should be run gradually took over. Porter watched this phenomenon, which is often called financialization, turn companies into the servants of their owners, to the detriment of other considerations. "The shareholder value mindset became very, very strong," he said. "People became fixated on it. It pulled them into short-term thinking. It caused decisions that might raise the stock price temporarily, but actually hurt a company's long-term prospects, or its workers, or customers, or community." "I've been on a bunch of boards," Porter said, "and I experience that when I go to board meetings, and we worry about an hour-to-hour score, and we start listening to that scorekeeper, the capital markets, and what they think we should do." An argument like, We need to pay workers a steady salary, which will cost us a lot in the low season, but will help us retain them over the long term, now could not be justified. An argument like, we need to pay workers a steady salary, which will cost us in both the short and the long term, but is the right thing to do, had no chance. I think we somehow, again, in the pursuit of efficiency and financial market sophistication and modeling and so forth, we found lots of ways to make money, Porter said. But it's somehow detached from what capitalism ultimately at its core is all about, which is about the real economy. The investing aspect of business had come to dominate those other aspects of it, involving building things, serving people, solving problems. Taken together, these changes had brought a great rationalizing to the business world, in two senses. They were the instruments through which business operations had been rationalized, and, not unimportantly, they were how business persons had rationalized their lives to themselves. Much of what Porter described had entered the business world through the atomizing protocols. With their help, businesses had straightened up their act over a generation, analyzing and optimizing everything. Porter was now allowing that some of it had been overdone. Somehow, many of these generally sensible types of practices in various aspects of business ended up overshooting, he said. The result was pain and chaos in so many lives. Now the protocols were turning up at foundations and government agencies and anti-poverty consulting firms as the solution to these woes. Some years after his meeting with Porter, Hinton found himself sitting across from another capitalist with concerns about modern capitalism. George Soros needed someone to run his new program on building more inclusive economies, preferably someone who hadn't bought into the protocols entirely. An ethnomusicologist with years in Western Mongolia under his belt, who had ended up with McKinsey and Goldman Sachs, seemed perfect. Hinton knew his rigorous business training was part of his appeal, but he added, presumably, some of why I'm there is because some of those other things that I did, and hopefully my Mongolian musicologist bit of me can come out a bit as well occasionally. He took up the new job, dividing his time between New York and London, and making his first forays into the new world of the social sector. He was surprised that so many of the people now tasked with helping the oppressed, whether at the Gates Foundation or the Omidyar Network or the Clinton Foundation, were fellow ex-consulting and or finance types like him. He knew how they operated. One thing that approach entirely fails to take into consideration, he said, is that the people who are the so-called beneficiaries of this help and this insight may themselves have the answer to the problems. Hinton described the assumption that he saw guiding the protocol bearers in their new public serving assignments. If we assemble enough brain power and enough money, we can crack this. We can solve these problems. Then the solutions can get scaled. This approach, he said, just fails to recognize that we are attempting to solve these problems with the very tools and the very minds that constructed the problems in the first place. Hinton saw how the protocols, redeployed to the war on hardship, could be very useful to market world. If we can suddenly be the white knight and ride in as the savior of the rest of the world, maybe it wasn't bad after all, he said of the system and ideas that market world upheld. Maybe it actually was good, and this is the chance to redeem capitalism. The protocols spread to social questions, also gave elites a chance to limit the range of possible answers. You absolutely constrain the solution set that you're prepared to look at, he said. It's kind of obvious, isn't it? If you only have English speakers in the car, then the solution is going to be done in English. In Hinton's view, it was not a matter of malice. It's the banality of inattentiveness, he said. It's not wickedness. It's not conscious self-censorship. It's just habit. He brought up that meeting of non-expert experts he had hosted in that conference room above West 57th Street. I'm guilty of that, he said. I've got a pretty broad Rolodex, but when you reach out to smart, articulate people like yourself. I mean, we all do that, so it self-replicates. He wondered aloud whether the larger project and the foundations behind it could be run differently. If he believed the protocol spread to be a colonization, what would decolonization look like? My assumption is that colonization is inevitable, he said. I think the idea of independence didn't even dawn on me. I didn't even ask the question. I feel foolish. What does decolonization look like? How would you reverse the trend? Well, I think it is necessary but not sufficient to have a dramatic shift in the complexion and the voices that are around the table. By that, he said, he didn't just mean the usual push for ethnic and gender diversity, nor the keeping around of tokens. What about having the kind of people the Foundation seek to help as part of the leadership? He asked. He was presently in the middle of constituting his board of advisors for the new economic advancement program. I haven't even questioned the assumption that I would be looking for people with depth of experience and elite credentials, he said. But what if he jettisoned that assumption and put, say, a primary school teacher on the board, one from India? Actually, I'm going to have a go at that idea, he said. He said he would try to put an ordinary person, one of the people on whose behalf those private equity and consulting types had been deliberating, on the board. That meant the nature of the meeting itself might have to change to accommodate a wider array of backgrounds. Maybe it was best to avoid PowerPoint. Maybe he would have to present in the form of a narrative talk or story or show a film. Ideas were churning. Hinton is a Baha'i, and the Universal House of Justice, the High Council of the religion, had once put out a statement about the appropriate way to seek the improvement of the world and the lives of other people. Justice demands universal participation. Thus, while social action may involve the provision of goods and services in some form, its primary concern must be to build capacity within a given population to participate in creating a better world. Social change is not a project that one group of people carries out for the benefit of another. Hinton believed in that idea. In his own life, he felt his faith to be one of the few forces strong enough to counterbalance the business way of thinking. The great flaw of that way, he said, is materialism. The business person tended to see work in utilitarian terms as something people do to feed themselves and acquire things. But there is a spiritual dimension, too. That work might be the expression of the inner desire to be productive and to be of service to one's community, and that the idea of denying someone the opportunity to fulfill that is like not letting a tree produce fruit. Many bearers of the business mind had, like him, a religious or spiritual life on the side, he said. But I think that somehow that thinking never overlaps with that mind. He added, people don't have permission to think about those things in their working life. We've decided that those are separate domains, and it's kind of not really okay in my circles to talk about religious faith. He had been hired for his skill at solving business problems using the protocols. His values were his own problem. That wasn't why I was invited to the party, he said. Chapter 6. Generosity and Justice. Wealth is like an orchard. You have to share the fruit, not the orchard. Carlos Slim. Darren Walker, topped by a furry drum of a Russian hat, sat in the back of a black Lincoln limousine, inching nervously toward West 57th Street and what he called the belly of the beast. His limo was heading to the New York office of KKR, the private equity firm immortalized in Barbarians at the Gate, a firm that had led the charge of the great rationalizing, one protocol-guided buyout at a time. Walker was the president of the Ford Foundation, and thus in the social justice business. He spent his days giving money away. Walker's assignment, to address a group of private equity executives at a luncheon, was complicated by a much publicized letter he had written some months before. The letter broke with the pleasantness that tends to prevail in the philanthropy world. It had raised, in sharp and provocative language, the question of what to do about the crisis of inequality. This in itself was disturbing to many rich people, who preferred to talk about reducing poverty or extending opportunity, not about more thoroughgoing reforms that would perhaps require sacrifice. Walker's letter had squarely blamed the very elites who give back through philanthropy for ignoring their complicity in causing the problems they later seek to solve. Before writing the letter, Walker had been universally popular with the plutocrats, which isn't to say that everyone disliked what he had written. Robert Rubin, late of Goldman Sachs, Citigroup, and the Treasury Department, told Walker he loved the letter, finding it fresh and different. He said he had never read anything that did that. But many plutocrats objected to Walker's shining the spotlight on inequality, instead of the issues they were more comfortable talking about, like poverty or opportunity. They disliked that he framed the issue in a way that blamed them, rather than inviting them to participate in a solution. They disliked his focus on how money is made, rather than how it is given away. "I just think you should stop ranting at inequality," a friend in private equity had snapped at him a few nights before the KKR event. "It's a real turnoff." Walker had broken what in his circles were important taboos. Inspire the rich to do more good, but never ever tell them to do less harm. Inspire them to give back, but never ever tell them to take less. Inspire them to join the solution, but never, ever accuse them of being part of the problem. The headline above Walker's letter on the Ford website read, "Toward a New Gospel of Wealth." He was attempting to revise and update, or perhaps overturn an old gospel that dates back to an era much like ours, a gospel that had itself transformed earlier American ideas of helping other people. The late historian Peter Dobkin Hall, an authority on the American giving tradition, traces it back to the late 17th and early 18th centuries as the colonial trade and commodities magnified differences in wealth and created an increasingly visible population of poor and dependent people for whom the public was expected to take responsibility. Before this time, Hall writes, much giving was to the public sphere, to government institutions themselves, or to entities like Harvard, which were regarded as public corporations subject to legislative oversight and supported significantly in the form of legislative grants of money. But an increasingly complex society and economy, thanks to growing international trade, immigration, a burgeoning market economy, population growth, and outbreaks of diseases like smallpox, inspired Americans to take matters into their own hands, according to Hall. He credits Cotton Mather, the revered Puritan clergyman in New England, with reframing prevailing ideas about charity, with his 1710 pamphlet Bonifacius. "The man who is not satisfying of the wisdom in making it the work of his life to do good is always to be beheld with the pity due to an idiot. None but a good man is really a living man, and the more good any man does, the more he really lives. All the rest is death, or belongs to it." Mather, in Hall's account, had specific ideas about what it meant to do good, advocating friendly visiting of the poor, the use of voluntary associations for mutual support, and philanthropic giving by the rich to relieve the poor and support schools, colleges, and hospitals. A marked feature of American giving before the age of big philanthropy was the helping of the many by the many. Groups for that purpose multiplied through the 18th and 19th centuries. Hall writes of a spreading view that the hazards and uncertainties of urban life could be mitigated through fraternal associations which helped members and their families financially in times of illness and death. Associations of artisans protected their members from exploitation and sought to ensure that they received fair prices for their work. In the 1830s, when Alexis de Tocqueville made his pilgrimage from Europe to America, he observed that Americans didn't wait for kings and popes to help people. They made associations, a phrase he helped make famous, to hold fetes, found seminaries, build inns, construct churches, distribute books, dispatch missionaries to the Antipodes. As the 19th century drew down, major changes in American life helped to develop these early tendencies into what is today called organized philanthropy. Acts of human kindness are as old as humankind, the scholars Lucy Bernholtz, Chiara Cordelli, and Rob Reich write in a recent book they edited, Philanthropy in Democratic Societies. The modern practice of organized philanthropy, on the other hand, has a much more recent provenance. Around the turn of the century, a new industrial capitalism flourished. Incredible fortunes were made in railroads, steel, oil, and other factors of a booming nation's growth. Much as is the case today, inequality widened as some seized on the new possibilities and others were displaced. Anger bubbled, and populist impulses surged. The money that was being made in this earlier Gilded Age was, in the view of many, unseemly in its quantities, unjust in its provenance, untenable in the power it conferred over a republic breaking out in new populist sentiments. It was also fuel for new ideas about giving. Growth in inequality might be a foe to civic comedy, but it is a friend to private philanthropy. Reich, a political scientist and a leading authority on charitable giving, writes in the book. In this moment, out of a mix of altruism and the self-preservational desire to cool public anger, some aging tycoons, notably Andrew Carnegie and John D. Rockefeller, began to give back. Frederick Gates, an advisor to Rockefeller, wrote to him, "Your fortune is rolling up like an avalanche. You must keep up with it. You must distribute it faster than it grows," which seems to suggest that among the things that distinguished the new philanthropy was an awareness of the age. At least some of the givers knew they had to calm this menacing concern and anger. The new form of charity birthed by this era was the private foundation, which, Risch argues, was different from the charities of the past, both in scale and in nature. It was an entity with broad and general purposes, intended to support other institutions and indeed to create and fund new organizations, e.g. research institutes, seeking to address root causes of social problems rather than deliver direct services, work wholesale rather than retail, and designed to be administered by private, self-governing trustees with paid professional staff who would act on behalf of a public mission. One other aspect of these foundations was new. Their vast resources enabled them to operate on a scale unlike other, more ordinary endowments. These foundations were, in other words, allowing a small handful of wealthy people like Carnegie and Rockefeller to commit monumental sums of money to the public good and thus gain a say in the nation's affairs that rivaled that of many public officials. Vast new foundations concerned themselves not with niche causes so much as with the general welfare of mankind, much like states. The new philanthropy was professionally managed by an entity analogous to a corporation, and, like governments, it was advised by experts, unlike the more willy-nilly voluntary associations. It was important, Rockefeller wrote at the time, to do this business of benevolence properly and effectively. This emerging philanthropy would be less and less about the local barn-raising Tocqueville witnessed, the coming together to solve common problems, and ever more about the private redistribution of wealth, usually first earned through private capitalist profit-making through a non-profit sector, writes Jonathan Levy, a historian at the University of Chicago. Despite the scale of the new generosity, there were criticisms. One had to do with how the money being given had been made. The new foundations were troubling, as Risch puts it, because they represented the wealth, potentially ill-gotten, of Gilded Age robber barons. When Rockefeller proposed to establish his benevolent foundation to deal with his avalanche of money, powerful voices resisted, railing that the money was tainted by its origins. No amount of charities in spending such fortunes can compensate in any way for the misconduct in acquiring them, said President Theodore Roosevelt. Memories remained fresh of Rockefeller's less than benevolent monopoly in oil and less than benevolent allergy to labor unions. Charles and Mary Beard wrote of the robber barons' raw plutocracy, of how they writhed and twisted, casting about for more respectable mantles of security and atonement. In the muckraking reporter Matthew Josephson's 1934 history, The Robber Barons, a term he is credited with coining, he wrote of how they hastened to confer substantial parts of the booty taken in successful raids, as if fearing that God would be angry unless much money was paid. Other criticism focused on how the new philanthropy not only laundered cruelly earned money, but also converted it into influence over a democratic society. Risch writes that the new foundations were troubling because they were considered a deeply anti-democratic institution, an entity that could exist in perpetuity and that was unaccountable except to a hand-picked assemblage of trustees. He cites as illustration the criticism of the Reverend John Haynes Holmes, a Unitarian minister who was a longtime chairman of the American Civil Liberties Union. "I take it for granted that the men who are now directing these foundations, for example, the men who are representing the Rockefeller Foundation, are men of wisdom, men of insight, of vision, and are also animated by the very best motives. My standpoint is the whole thought of democracy. From this standpoint, it seems to me that this foundation, the very character, must be repugnant to the whole idea of a democratic society." As Risch points out, it is rare to hear such criticisms today. "We have come a long way in 100 years," he writes. "Philanthropists are today widely admired, and the creation of foundations by the wealthy meets not with public or political skepticism, but with civic gratitude. It is hard to imagine an American president or very many influential journalists condemning rich people for giving their money away. Indeed, in cases of exceptions to that rule among journalists, the rule is quickly reinforced by other journalists. When David Callahan, the founder of the website Inside Philanthropy, and one of the few influential chroniclers of the field with a critical bent of mind, recently published The Givers, a book on the subject, the attitude of his New York Times reviewer, a fellow journalist, revealed the benefits these givers have reaped from a century of persuasion. Many readers will be ready to throw up their hands in exasperation. So now we're supposed to fret about rich people being too socially conscious? What exactly does this guy want? It might have seemed unimaginable in the early 20th century, when the concern about philanthropists was common, that by the early 21st century, journalists could shoot down colleagues for criticizing elite power. But in those days, unlike today, giving back didn't purchase immunity for the giver. It didn't make people smile and bite their tongues about the money's origins. It didn't make journalists feel bad for the rich and rush to their defense. It didn't silence questions about the system in which the wealth was generated. The culture in which giving achieved these things had to be invented and spread. Eventually it was, and among the foundational intellectual contributions to the new culture was an 1889 essay by Andrew Carnegie, a man with a great interest in how philanthropy would come to be seen. Carnegie's essay, titled Wealth, and more widely known as his Gospel of Wealth, helped to found a new vision of philanthropy that not only rebutted the kinds of criticisms that he and others had faced, but effectively delegitimized critics and questioned their right to question. Carnegie set out to explain away all the grisly things he and other big givers had done to make the money, and to temper the concerns about private power over public affairs in a democracy. What the critics seemed to desire was a world in which the Carnegies and Rockefellers were less extreme in their taking phase, which would leave them with less to give away, and thus limit the amount of authority they wielded. If Carnegie was to counter this, he would have to argue that a time of extreme taking, followed by a time of extreme giving, was better than the alternative. Carnegie's Gospel, published in the North American Review, deftly began by naming the problems on the critics' minds. He argued that inequality was the undesirable but inevitable cost of genuine progress. The conditions of human life have not only been changed, but revolutionized, he wrote. Inequality is a better thing than it may seem, Carnegie explained. The contrast between the palace of the millionaire and the cottage of the laborer with us today measures the change which has come with civilization. This change, however, is not to be deplored, but welcomed as highly beneficial. Stratification was the price of the onward chugging of progress. Of course, even if inequality was the price of progress, the rising millionaires of the age didn't have to extract quite so much from their industries and pay the laborers quite so little. Refraining from such greed would allow the laborers to upgrade from cottages, if not to palaces, then at least to decent houses. Carnegie rejected this. There is no choice, he said, but to operate in the most aggressive, if miserly way, lest you go out of business. Under the law of competition, the employer of thousands is forced into the strictest economies, among which the rates paid to labor figure prominently, and often there is friction between the employer and the employed, between capital and labor, between rich and poor. This is the first step of Carnegie's intellectual two-step. If you want progress, you have to let rich people make their money however they can, even if it widens inequality. Business persons deserve this permission, he said, because this talent for organization and management is rare among men. Its methods aren't to be questioned. Carnegie wrote, "We accept and welcome, therefore, as conditions to which we must accommodate ourselves, great inequality of environment, the concentration of business, industrial, and commercial in the hands of a few." Lest there be doubt that these industrial stewards know best, Carnegie said their talent is proved by the fact that it invariably secures for its possessor enormous rewards. In other words, rich people must be freed to make money however they can, because when they are, they tend to make a lot of money, which in turn brings progress for all. In this way, Carnegie effectively declared the economic system that generates wealth off-limits for the discussion. It was now time to turn to the giving half of the gospel. The question then arises, and if the foregoing be correct, it is the only question with which we have to deal. What is the proper mode of administering wealth after the laws upon which civilization is founded have thrown it into the hands of the few? Considering various ways to give away wealth, Carnegie derided the two most common approaches, giving to descendants and giving after death. The former approach bred feeble children. The latter wasted many years of potential helping while a benefactor waited to die. Carnegie, in fact, unlike many rich people then and now, believed in a punitive estate tax that would encourage philanthropy. Of all forms of taxation, this seems the wisest. If the rich knew that much of the money would vanish upon their deaths, they might be persuaded to donate it to good causes during their lifetimes. Actively giving one's wealth away was the only approach Carnegie supported, because wealth, in his view, belonged to the community. Keeping was hoarding. A rich man should practice modest, unostentatious living, shunning display or extravagance. Of what wealth remained, he was the mere agent and trustee for his poorer brethren. Hoarding was thus akin to thieving the public. Men who continue hoarding great sums all their lives, the proper use of which for public ends would work good to the community, should be made to feel that the community, in the form of the state, cannot thus be deprived of its proper share. Here, the justifier of extreme taking had laid out a doctrine of extreme giving. It isn't just good to give to the public. Money that you don't need and that the public could employ isn't really your money. Carnegie was proposing an extreme idea of the right to make money in any which way, and an extreme idea of the obligation to give back. It is a strange, seemingly contradictory picture, writes Levy, the historian. Carnegie at his desk, writing one letter to his lieutenants at the Carnegie Steel Company, imploring them to slash wages, then writing another to one of his philanthropic lieutenants, giving his wealth, the profits earned by slashing those wages, away at his own discretion. For Carnegie, then, inequality was a brief state between the taking and giving phases. Giving back, he wrote, is the true antidote for the temporary unequal distribution of wealth, the reconciliation of the rich and the poor, a reign of harmony. This idea of temporary inequality is vital. For Carnegie, inequality is transitional, a necessity for progress, but soon reversible thanks to the fruits of that progress. Carnegie seemed to anticipate the objection that the poor might not need so much help had they been better paid. Dripping with paternalism, he defended the necessity of temporary inequality. Wealth, passing through the hands of the few, can be made a much more potent force for the elevation of our race than if it had been distributed in small sums to the people themselves, he wrote. By small sums, he makes clear in the ensuing sentences, he is referring to wages. Citing the case of Peter Cooper, industrialist turned philanthropist and the founder and namesake of Cooper Union in Manhattan, Carnegie wrote, "Much of this sum, if distributed in small quantities among the people, would have been wasted in the indulgence of appetite, some of it in excess, and it may be doubted whether even the part put to the best use, that of adding to the comforts of the home, would have yielded results for the race, as a race, at all comparable to those which are flowing and are to flow from the Cooper Institute from generation to generation." Carnegie believed that he could not pay workers well, could not be sentimental about how many hours of work were too many, for that would hurt the public interest. But he could give back to the workers. He financed libraries, museums, and other public amenities for the eventual pleasure and edification of his underpaid workers. He wrote, "Thus is the problem of rich and poor to be solved. The laws of accumulation will be left free. The laws of distribution free. Individualism will continue, but the millionaire will be but a trustee for the poor, entrusted for a season with a great part of the increased wealth of the community, but administering it for the community far better than it could or would have done for itself." This is the compromise, the truce distilled. "Leave us alone in the competitive marketplace, and we will tend to you after the winnings are won. The money will be spent more wisely on you than it would be by you. You will have your chance to enjoy our wealth, in the way we think you should enjoy it. Here lay the almost constitutional principles that one day would govern market world giving. The idea that after the fact benevolence justifies anything goes capitalism. That callousness and injustice in the cutthroat souk are excused by later philanthropy. That giving should not only help the underdogs, but also, and more important, serve to keep them out of the top dog's hair. And, above all, that generosity is a substitute for and a means of avoiding the necessity of a more just and equitable system and a fairer distribution of power. 127 years after Carnegie's essay was published, everyone at a charity gala in New York seems to have internalized its core principles. The organization raising money helps troubled, vulnerable, and poor New Yorkers find work, housing, skills, companionship, and safety. The whole night is divided into two types of performances from the stage. The young and the helped, mostly black and brown, repeatedly dance for their donors. Then, between performances, older white men are brought up to praise them and to talk about and be applauded for their generosity to the program. Most of the men work in finance. They include the corporate raiders who, seeking to raise profits by cutting costs, have helped to do away with stable employment. They are the gentrifiers who have pushed real estate prices through the roof and made it harder for families like those of the young dancers to maintain a livelihood in the city. They are the beneficiaries of tax laws that give carried interest a major break and help to keep the public coffers low and the schools attended by the city's poor underfunded, thus driving them into the streets and occasionally, when they are lucky, into the charity's arms. But these men have been generous, and in exchange for their generosity, these issues will not come up. No one will say what could be said, that these precarious lives could be made less precarious if the kind of men who donated to this program made investments differently, operated companies differently, managed wealth differently, donated to politicians differently, lobbied differently, thought differently about pretending to live in Florida to avoid a minor New York City tax. If, in other words, they were willing to let go of anything dear. It is one night in one city, but it speaks of a broad, unstated immunity deal. Generosity entitles the winners to exemption from questions like these. On his way to the top of the philanthropic world, Darren Walker had attended more galas of that type than he could count, and had endured his share of wealthy white people saying nice things about him while refusing to see a connection between their lives and the nearly inescapable life that he had escaped. And this was one way to explain the letter he wrote challenging the immunity deal, to explain how he mustered the gall to break the taboo. "Look at Darren," he mimicked his admirers cooing. "Why can't they all be like Darren? I mean, look at Darren. He had a single mother, he put himself through school, you know, he never had a father, he didn't even know who his father is." The question that his life raised for them was, why couldn't all poor people end up like Darren Walker? "Part of my job," he told me one day in his Ford Foundation office, "is to remind them why they can't all be like me. What we have done to make it harder for people like me, with my background, with my heritage, to be able to end up with my story, and how systematically we are completely making it impossible for stories like mine to continue to emerge in the years ahead, because we're doing horrible things now, and I feel like I need to do that. I just feel like I need to do that." This impulse had taken a long time to develop, though, because at first, Walker was not a natural critic of the philanthropic complex, so much as a natural poster child for its good works. He was born in Louisiana at the Lafayette Charity Hospital. The rich families had their own hospitals and clinics, and the poor whites and African Americans were tended by institutions of charity. Walker's mother found herself in a harsh predicament. A black mother, in this small town, not married, had two babies with this man, and obviously he's not going to marry her, Walker said. His mother, who was wonderful and perhaps challenged in many, many ways, had the foresight and the ambition to realize, "I need to get out." She moved the family to Liberty County, Texas, to the town of Ames, the county's Negro town, as Walker put it. Walker's mother studied to become a nurse's assistant and soon earned her certificate. She always worked, but it was not enough to keep poverty at bay. Walker remembers being at their tiny house and the electric man or the telephone man coming by to cut off service on their past due account, and he would negotiate with them, ask for a grace period or at least enough time for his mother to go out, cash her check, and return. One day a woman showed up at the home asking if she could register Darren for something called Head Start. His mother agreed, not knowing much about it. Here was charity again blessing Walker, but charity that functioned as a humble complement to government action. Starting in the 1920s, the Rockefellers and other donors had funded research on children. Much of it was based at the University of Iowa's Child Welfare Research Station, where scholars established the then controversial idea that children's success depended more on the opportunities given to them than on heredity. These researchers had made their case quietly and in the shadows of politics over decades. Then, what began as charity became public policy when, on May 18, 1965, President Lyndon B. Johnson stood in the Rose Garden of the White House and announced a new initiative to ensure that poverty's children would not be forevermore poverty's captives. Within weeks, the government would open 2,500 preschool programs aiming to reach 530,000 children. The goal was to prepare them to attend school in the autumn and to treat the tens of thousands of them who had health impediments. One of the first 500,000 enrollees would be Walker. He also benefited from the kindness and wisdom of a schoolteacher named Mrs. Majors, who told Walker he was talented, but that his behavior risked his being placed in special ed, where the system sent too many black boys, who from there traveled with near inevitability down a pipeline into prison. Mrs. Majors' sociological insight was sound. "Six of my cousins, my male cousins, have been in prison," Walker says. "One of them committed suicide in prison. All of them were in this pipe." Mrs. Majors' warning helped him turn himself around. His path showed him the power of interventions large and small to transform individual lives. But there were moments along the way which reminded him that nothing changed if you didn't change the system as a whole. For example, when he was 12, he worked as a busboy out of necessity to supplement his mother's paycheck in order to keep their household afloat. Years later, he would tell the trustees of the Ford Foundation, who were considering him as a potential leader, that the restaurant job had prepared him for the role more than any of the others he had had. Given his age, he might have been working illegally, and he felt something visceral and dark in the job. He felt what it was like to live on the margins of human society. The restaurant took the long-standing but abstract facts of his life and staged them as a vivid performance. "You walk around a room where there is excess and plentifulness and people of economic means who actually have the disposable income to go out and eat and pay more than what the food actually costs to have a meal and drink nice wine," Walker said. "And you walk around on the periphery of that room and you are invisible. You're invisible even when you are taking away the plates and cleaning up after people. You're invisible. No one says thank you. No one acknowledges your presence. And that experience, for me, remains the most profound and the most important." Still, he bought into the American story that exceptional individuals can work and buy their way out of powerlessness. As his cousins circulated in and out of prison, he made it to the University of Texas at Austin, where he earned undergraduate and law degrees. He joined the international law firm of Cleary, Gottlieb, Steen, and Hamilton. He moved to UBS, the financial services firm, where for 7 years he worked in the capital markets division. He quit and took a year off to volunteer in Harlem, feeling the pull of social uplift. The experience of helping families like his own moved him. He joined the Abyssinian Development Corporation, a community development organization in Harlem, and focused on the building of public housing and a public school. Then he moved on to the Rockefeller Foundation, where he was told by a colleague that he wasn't the usual Rockefeller type, not because he was black, it was a new day, but because he was gay. Finally, he landed the Ford job, overseeing a multi-billion-dollar investment portfolio. In keeping with his official position and his own joyous magnetism, his careful irreverence, his attention to everyone in a room, He soared into the upper echelons of New York society. He was a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. He was on the boards of the city's ballet, of Rockefeller philanthropy advisors, of Friends of the High Line. He began to be first name dropped. You know, Darren was saying the other day, Darren and I were on a panel and one day he would be at a White House state dinner for the Chinese president. Another day he would be in Silicon Valley helping Mark Zuckerberg reflect on his giving. Even as he was establishing himself in big philanthropy, there were constant reminders of what his and his colleagues' efforts were persistently failing to change. He was at a gala one night when he received a text from his sister with photographs from the funeral of his aunt Bertha. In one of the pictures, Walker noticed a cousin of his. He was wearing a prison jumpsuit, and an unknown white man was standing behind him. Walker texted back, "What is with that?" She answered that in Louisiana, they sometimes let you out of prison for a relative's funeral. You pay a service fee, and a police officer comes with you. On another day, another message, another funeral. A different cousin of his had died. The cousin's family had no money, and so Walker's mother covered the cost, using the credit card that Walker pays for her. The dissonance with his own life grew louder with time, as did his questioning about his complicity. His compensation was to be $789,000 that year. He wore fabulous clothes, had billionaire friends, attended lavish galas, dined at sumptuous restaurants, lived in a luxurious condominium on Madison Square Park, which was sweetened by a tax abatement that he did not need. The tax abatement bothered Walker. It played into his guilt. He lived among millionaires and billionaires who had secured for themselves a tax break for their apartments and his. Money that could have been invested in his cousins and all those others he had left behind in Texas. Would he or anyone else, however principled, renounce the tax break? Of course not. That's why he had begun to feel a need to talk about systems. Why do we live in a society where that can happen, he asked, and what do we need to fix that? And we who are privileged ought to be engaged in that, because we can't say, on the one hand, isn't it horrible, this affordable housing crisis we have in New York, and then, by the same token, accept a system that is essentially corrupt. He mused, I really wonder about my own privilege, and am I too comfortable in it? He said his guilt definitely nags at me on a daily basis. Social scientists speak of idiosyncrasy credits, a kind of resource that a leader earns which allows him or her from time to time to innovate on or even defy group norms. Walker had been working hard at racking up credits. As you're working your way up, you have to be nuanced and you have to pick those battles, he said. Now, at Ford, he had reached that pinnacle. People return my calls. I don't have to go see Bob Rubin and Roger Altman. They come to the Ford Foundation. In fact, the two men, who had rotated in and out of the highest levels of government and finance for decades, had just walked out of his office. Walker's new status made him ask himself what he could do with it, how he could leverage his position on the inside of the circle to help those he had left behind on the outside. That was what he meant by his answer to one of the trustees' questions during his interview for the Ford role. He was asked, "What kind of president will you be?" To which he answered, I would want to use the platform of being president of the Ford Foundation to really deeply interrogate the structures and systems and cultural practices in our country that increase the likelihood of more inequality in our society and of more exclusion and marginalization of people, particularly low-income people, people of color. Walker knew the kind of world he wanted to fight for and knew there were many different ways to go about it. One was to drop out of the stratosphere into which he had risen, to quit what he called the globe-trotting jet set of people going from Davos to Bellagio to Aspen talking about solving poverty. Walker did struggle with the contradiction in that, and yet he was also realistic about who he was, which was some combination of the angry busboy and the UBS banker. What he could do, he concluded, was persuade winners who had let him inside their gates. He could convince them that many of the stories they told themselves and others weren't true, and that these false stories had dire consequences. When stripped of those stories, perhaps a new conversation about equality and a fair society would be possible. Perhaps they would see the self-preservational quality of so many of their approaches to social change. Perhaps. Walker's letter went online in October 2015. It began to ricochet around the philanthropic world, some people receiving the same email from three or four different people. It shook up the giving universe and got people talking. Walker's new gospel began where he had to begin, with Carnegie. That text was, Walker said, the intellectual charter of modern philanthropy, and its basic precepts